Welcome to Comics,
episode 256. This week, we talk about
The Omega Men.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes, see what we're reading next, send us a message, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast begins.
You want to just get started then?
David joining us?
No, David has requested a hiatus for the next, month or two.
Okay.
Just with his wife doing class, he's, struggling to read for the show. He told me he wasn't even reading his regular polls. So we'll see if we can get a guest in for a couple more episodes for the best of Marvel stuff.
All right.
See if I can find somebody. Shouldn't be too difficult. I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah. Oh my god, if you just don't fucking Google Kyle Rayner speaks Spanish. I did that at lunch and I was mad at the world.
Well, now I have to, I'm typing it in as you tell me not to type it in.
Well, I ended up on a really social justice-y thread on Comic Vine because I just wanted an explanation. Because I didn't know that he was Hispanic, and apparently they're taking the Star Trek eugenics bent on it, so if his dad is Mexican, even though he wasn't raised knowing his dad's Mexican, he can now speak Spanish and he's full-blown Catholic.
This was all new to me too. Actually, fuck it, yeah, let's just start the episode.
This week's comic.
Okay. This week we read The Omega Men, issues 1 to issue 7 by Tom King, and apparently Kyle Rayner's Latino. I mean, I read the Kyle Rayner run. That's when I got into Green Lantern, was when Hal Jordan went insane and there was this new Green Lantern. Because I always thought Green Lanterns were cool, but I was really intimidated by the whole size of the core, and I didn't really like Hal that much. And the other two were harder to get into, because John Stewart just didn't have that many stories about him, and Guy Gardner was a dick, and when you're a kid, that's not really what you want to read. But suddenly they're like, okay, get rid of all that, and now there's Kyle Rayner. And Kyle Rayner was cool, and I read that entire run of Kyle Rayner's solo run on Green Lantern. And then when he moved to Green Lantern Corps after he became the Torchbearer, all that stuff, through the ring, the color wars, I don't know what they call them. And he was never Latino through any of that, and never Catholic. So when I read this, I was like, where the fuck did this come from?
So I got on the internets, and apparently Kyle Rayner's dad was a spy or something for the CIA, and he's actually Mexican. But he spent his entire time pretending to be some rando white dude. So unless anyone with the right genetics can just speak Spanish, I don't see, the way I'm viewing this in my head is that Kyle Rayner took theology and Spanish as his electives in college, and that would explain this.
Yeah, because I mean, the whole having the CIA Mexican dad, I remember that. That was part of his story. For a long time, they just ignored the fact that he had parents in the comics. And then, they got into stuff with his parents. And, okay, it was weird. And he was weird. He was weirded out by it himself. But, okay, fine, whatever. It's comics, whatever. Mexican CIA guy, sure. Whatever.
Yeah, why not?
Sure. But even, he never spoke Spanish. I read him for literally a decade, and he never spoke Spanish. Not once. And it's one of those things, yeah, if he'd been doing it all along, I don't know. It doesn't make sense either, because he was a solo book, and his story was that he was a single guy, a bachelor dude living in the city. So half of the scenes of him were his private life hanging out at home. So it's not even you could retcon and say, oh, he was, speaking Spanish every time he was at home, when you weren't reading about him, because you were reading about him at home.
Yeah. And that's what gets me. So Googling this because I was like, I didn't know he spoke Spanish. That's really cool. And I just wanted like some background. Like I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so I learned that from the internet, mind you, if we made him not speak Spanish, that would be whitewashing him. So that would be racist.
Oh, Christ.
And that all authors from the point where he got retconned into being Latino are either ignorant or racist for drawing him and portraying him as white. And I was just like, I weep for the world. I mean it's super cool. Like, it's a cool character trait, but as far as I knew Kyle Rayner didn't speak Spanish, and it was just like super weird to see this like Roman Catholic praying to the angel of God side of him out of nowhere.
Yeah, and that gets me more, because like, speaking Spanish, fine, whatever. Yeah, maybe he took a language course. Like, maybe he found out his dad was Mexican. He's like, cool, I'm into my heritage. I should read this. But like the heavy Catholicism. I shouldn't just cuss right when we're talking about the Lord. The heavy Catholicism comes out of nowhere, and it feels I don't know. It's really difficult when you talk about race, because I feel the same way about this when, like, okay, they're casting Iron Fist for the Netflix serial, right? And everybody's saying, don't make him a white guy. That's whitewashing. Make him an Asian dude. And part of me wants to be like, why isn't that more racist to say, oh, Kung Fu should be an Asian guy? Like,
I have, like, super strong feelings about portrayal of Asians in the media, being that I am Asian, and this
feels like the same thing. Like, yeah. Oh, he's Mexican. Oh, he's probably Catholic then, right? Yeah, he's Catholic. Yeah, sure. Like, his religion was never a big part of his character. I don't see why it had to be just because he changed into a Mexican. Like, it's like they're trying to be progressive, but they go about it the totally wrong way. Like, okay, you don't want to make Iron Fist, you know, a white guy. Fine. Don't go stereotypical either. Make him fucking Middle Eastern for all I care.
That'd
you know?
Be awesome.
Make him black and make Power Man white. Like, you can literally do whatever you want with these characters. They're fictional. They don't exist. So long as you can carry over the themes that matter for the characters, the themes that define them and make them fun to read and interesting, then great. So Kyle can be Mexican dude speaking Spanish because he's into a heritage. Maybe make him Muslim. I don't know. Make him Buddhist. He could be literally fucking... He lived in New York City. You know? Like, he could have picked up any religion in his decades of New York City. But he, Mexican, so Catholic.
And it's absolutely not that my complaint is that he's religious. It's that I've read a lot of Kyle Rayner as well, and this just like came out of the blue. Like, I didn't know this was a character trait.
No, and one of my favorite portrayals of religion in comics is DC Universe, and it's the Huntress, Helena Bertinelli.
Yeah.
Is a hardcore Catholic. And every once in a while, before she suits up or before she goes out to fight, you see her pray. And like, she always has the cross around her neck, and I mean, it's the sluttiest way possible sometimes, but they incorporate it into her costume. Like, her costume is a cross half the time. And it doesn't feel contrived. It's a natural part of her character, and it defines her and who she is, and it's part of her motives, and it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's always been part of her. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think that, I don't like to see very flat characters. I think that it's wonderful when people create real people that are characters who are nuanced and interesting and come from like a lot of different backgrounds and situations. But like, it's like you said, you know, you can't just have every fucking famous Asian person on TV be Kung Fu Man. And you can't like, it's weird when you stereotype, and the reason Huntress doesn't come off as stereotyped is because, yes, it is like a huge part of her Italian heritage, but it's been built in from the start.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it more part of who she is as a person. These beliefs are integrated into a lot of her stories. She like clashes with her Catholicism and desire for vengeance at times. Like, she has to figure this shit out, and it's interesting for her as a character. She's not just randomly like, you know, Lord save me when she's in a tight situation. And I don't know, like, honestly, I'm not actually terribly bothered when people do racial stereotypes, but if you want to get all, like, up in arms about shit, like, isn't it just as bad to say, oh, if Kyle is half Mexican, he must be Catholic, as it is to say, oh, he must wear a sombrero and eat tacos? I think those two, if you're coming from that perspective, ought to be, like, equally bad.
Yeah. And I mean, I
don't know.
Like, and I also don't want to poo-poo, you retcon these characters because you want to do something new with a Green Lantern, right? Like, you want to see how having this all-powerful ring and how roaming the universe and experiencing extraterrestrial, like, experiencing life as a Green Lantern intersects with Catholicism that says that there's one true God and that that one true God is in the heavens above Earth. Like, that's interesting stuff. I'd be willing to read that. It just, and it's not that I'm against this portrayal of a character. It's just that it feels tacked on to this guy. Like, why tack it on to Kyle Rayner, who has decades of established character in him? Like, why retcon that instead of making a new character? Like, they made Simon Baz, a brand new Green Lantern, who was Middle Eastern American and Muslim. And granted, his character design was terrible. He has a Green Lantern ring in one hand and, like, a friggin' six shooter in the other. Like, or not even a six shooter, just like a shitty, pistol. Like, why do you need a pistol if you have... Okay, whatever. The character design's bad, but, like, they wanted to have a Middle Eastern Muslim character in the DC Universe, and they wanted to give him a lantern ring, so they made a new character. And the wonderful thing about Green Lanterns is you could fucking make a ton of them. It literally doesn't matter at all.
Yeah. Like, he is cool, though. Like, yeah. I like his character.
Yeah, and you know what you could even do? You could even have an alien come to Earth, discover Catholicism, and convert. And I think that would be the sickest fucking thing ever. That would be so sick. And that'd be, you could do such great stories with that. But no, we're just going to tack it on to this existing character in a way that feels contrived and kind of racist-ish? I don't know.
But, you know, okay. It's just that it's done, like, out of the blue. Because I don't know. Like you said, I feel like we've both read enough of Kyle to be like, hey, did you just, like, wake up like this today? Because if they had him look into this, like, say, I am a Green Lantern, but I'm failing as a Green Lantern because I can't save everybody, and then, like, look to religion and develop that over a course of time. And maybe I've got it totally wrong and they did that in some run and this isn't random. But from what little I was able to find on it, I didn't see much. Like, if they develop that, I think that would be a fascinating way to develop the character over time. Because I don't have an issue with retconning, but I think that it needs to come about naturally. And you can't just be like, you know, just like, you shouldn't randomly resurrect characters for no reason. You shouldn't randomly change core beliefs or who they are. Out of the blue. You need to get to that point through development and writing.
Yeah, and I think that's... I don't know when this change happened, but I'm willing to bet it was sometime around the New 52.
Yes. I think...
I don't know. I want to chalk everything up to all these reboots. That. Yeah, the father came in before that, but his being Catholic and speaking Spanish, I think, might have chimed in around New 52. But
yeah, and I...
That's not to say necessarily so, though.
Some of my confusion, too, spans from the fact that I am under the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of stuff did change in the New 52, but all the Green Lantern stuff did stay the same, like even the people.
The storyline, yeah. The main storyline, okay. The characters, Green Lantern, because it was basically Geoff Johns redesigning the DC Universe as he saw fit, and he had already done that in the Green Lantern book. So they just kept it as it was.
Okay. So yeah, there's... It felt unprecedented and a little, like, janky that he starts praying.
Yeah, and beyond that, I really didn't like his character in this. He just seemed, I don't know, he has every, because the woman in the he is the boyfriend of the titular woman in a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And every writer, it seems like, who takes over his character wants to reinterpret what that means to him, to make it somehow more important or more fundamental to his character than just being a woman in a refrigerator. Or like, everybody wants to retcon that experience or redefine that experience as it means to his character. And I appreciate what Tom King tried to do here with Kyle, but it makes him feel so whiny and douchey and like a huge ego complex. Like the hubris to think that you could come into this place and solve all of their problems for them just because your girlfriend died in a refrigerator. Like, I know that's not what it really is, but that's kind of what it feels like it boils down to.
Yeah, I mean, talk about Catholic guilt, right?
Just bring that in right now. Right now.
Yeah.
But, it fits now.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I didn't mind that development because obviously if you're a hero, you're going to be a person who feels guilty about what you could not do. Because the rest of us are just like, you know, dicking around, living our lives and not thinking about that. But if it's your job to save everybody, you feel bad.
Yeah.
So I get that. But at the same time, I don't know, like, there is something really predictable about the princess. And the moment Callista came on and started talking to Kyle, I was like, oh shit, she's going to betray him.
And how shocked her. Oh yeah. No, she did. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of obvious this was going to go south. And, you know, this is the thing. This is not just this comic. This is almost every comic. If the relationship isn't established canon, that woman will betray you or die. Right? Like,
yeah. I do want to say, though, because we've spent the first, like, 15 minutes of this recording shitting all over this comic. Or shitting all over Kyle, at least. But I think Kyle's the only character I really didn't like in this. Callista's a little predictable, sure. But I like the weird twist in her character about how she's vain.
Yeah, and, you know, don't get me wrong. I actually don't have an issue with this comic at all. I enjoyed reading it, and I didn't even have an issue with Kyle. I just thought that it was super weird, like this personality shift. Because to me, I think religion is like one of those things that people have like ingrained in the core. So like it's a character trait.
Yeah.
Where'd this come from?
Yeah. It's one like of those fundamentals.
To me, it's like if you woke up and you were black, you're like, Kyle, you were black yesterday. What happened?
Oh my God. The uproar that would happen there. But that feels like less of a change to me. It really, really does. Because I'm thinking about the first, like, 10 years of Kyle Rayner living in New York, and all of those stories would be the exact same if he were black.
Yeah, it wouldn't change anything.
Would change so little.
You'd be like, what happened? This is odd.
But, like, and seriously, I would love somebody to rewrite the Ion story with him being Catholic. Because we read The Power of Ion for this show, where basically Kyle comes to the epiphany that all of the lantern's power is now in the primary battery on Oa, and he has the only ring that channels all of it. So he realizes, through his epiphany, that his willpower has been constrained by his idea of what the ring is. And he changes it. He changes his idea of the ring to encompass all of Oa, and he basically becomes a god. You remember that comic?
Mm-hmm. It was very good.
It was a really good out of nowhere comic. There's some weird scenes in it, but it was really, really good. And I would love to read that with him being Catholic.
Yeah, actually.
Like, he literally has a discussion with Spectre, who is defined as being the left hand of God. Like the punishing hand of God. And Spectre says, you're more powerful than I am. The only person in DC Universe more powerful than Spectre is like the one true God. And Kyle be right there between the two now. And I want to know what that's like. I would love to read, like, it's not that I would have a problem with the Catholic Lantern because there's so many cool stories you could do, and this wasn't one of them.
Yeah. And, you know, that's actually, like, that's a good point. Like, that would be awesome, because if you think about it, someone like Huntress, she's just, like, a fairly wealthy, strong, normal person, but I would love to see a story about a superhero someone like way, way more powered than normal people colliding with religion. And you know, how does that play out if you were raised with like an earth religion? And, you know, if you're suddenly way more powerful than human, what does that make you? That could be a really interesting comic.
Yeah, and I would love to see a hardcore Catholic person, like, dropping off those little flyers all over Oa. Jesus died for your sins, alien.
so like an airport Catholic? Like,
oh my god, the yes! Like a hardcore evangelical, oh my god.
Oh no.
That'd be so much fun. No. That'd be so much fun. Anyway.
But, yeah, you know, aside from the Catholicism stuff, I do think that religion was, like, a major theme in here. It was interesting. Like, it added flavor, but wasn't plot necessary, right? And that's not a complaint on my part. I like that it was just world building. Like,
oh, no. I think it totally was plot necessary. I don't know how overt this is, but I read... This is probably because we have fucking literature degrees. But I read this, and I was like, oh, my God, this is fantastic. This is, like... This is the theme of terrorism and colonialism and the powerful West dominating the East and taking its resources and pushing down the natives, making them fight each other. And each one of these planets kind of represents different ways in which the West dominates the East. And when I say the East, I don't necessarily mean Asia. I mean, like, Western Europe dominating the traditionally called the East and the Middle East and Africa and, like, the slave trade and all this kind of stuff seemed so built into there. And the way that religion is used to do those things is the way that Citadel is using religion against these people. I don't know how much, I mean, do these people even really, the people that are in power really even believe their religion? The Chandra Gayan, whatever it was, the Brutes people, they don't seem to really believe. I mean, they kind of do so much as it benefits them, but I don't know. I think it was super important.
We only have the perspective of their leadership, right? Because it is a religious planet. And like, even at the start, their plot is to get the ship back. And I think they said like they finagled it so that the pilot of the ship had to go to the temple and then Brute could murder him and take the ship.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there were a lot of people who had this specific belief, but it was just like the high priests, the pontifex,
yeah,
and his bros who were like corrupt. And I mean, that's kind of that's a Catholic Church history too.
Yeah,
you know, in the Middle Ages and before and after that, I mean, like, for instance, priests aren't allowed to marry, not because of, historically, not because of a tie to God, but because they didn't want dudes having a bunch of kids and giving away like all the church money, because the church had a lot of money,
yeah,
and power. And I think like this is supposed to be much like that. And like, for instance, the whole treasure thing, like, I now have treasure and you can now be the Dauphin again, you can be my son. It made it seem like it was just him and maybe some guys that he was bribing, but not overall the religion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more we read this, the more important the religion will become. But I think if you really wanted to get in here and do a critical analysis and break this bad boy down, I think the religion is actually a big part of this book and the way it intersects with themes of terrorism and colonialism and uprising. And that stuff, I think, is really, really cool.
Damn, Andy. He went all in on this one.
I don't know. I just, as I was reading, I was like, I was reading it and I was thinking, you know, this is a fun read with this team of misfits. But I realize that you could, the themes that are in here are fun to break apart and fun to get into. If you want to take the time. I didn't have the time because I was like, shit, I gotta read, we're recording tonight. But you totally could.
Yeah, and that's what I like about this most. I think it does have a lot of depth. I really liked that they took the time to show you how each team member is from a different world in this mm-hmm. system, and then go into each of those worlds and what they believe and how they subjugate their people specifically.
Yeah.
And then the one world that's not subjugated and people are like, it's chaos. But it doesn't seem that bad comparatively.
I think the free, quote unquote, free world where all the natives aren't subjugated, and it's like the planet of trade and everything. I'm willing to bet that planet is, if we were to read the next 7 issues, that planet will end up being like a commentary on the way in which capitalism, you can have the division of wealth be what drives that economy. Like, yeah, sure, everybody's kind of, all the natives are kind of better off and a little bit richer, but let's face it, you know, there's the one percenters that actually control the planet.
Yeah, and, you know, we actually see slaves being bought and sold in a couple of the frames. Like, that's clearly what's happening in the background. So, you know, it obviously has its problems, but I think in the scope of, like, let's execute 4,000 slaves from an opposing tribe.
I mean, you know, as they go.
Yeah, the whole, like, Citadel Run area seems like utter shit.
Yeah.
If you're asking me, but...
But I really want to know what's on the planet, the one that has the shield up around it. Vrul? Or Vrul? I always forget where the arrow...
Vrul. There's too many vowels and consonants not in a good order there. I cannot say that.
But, like, I love the idea of, like, the Citadel expanding and setting up all this stuff on all these different planets, and the last planet just going, nope, 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 nope. Shield, put up a shield. Nobody comes in, nobody goes out. Put up a shield. Nope, nope.
Dude, if I had those guys as neighbors, I'd be like, fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn, these societies are really messed up.
Yeah. So which of these characters, other than Kyle, did you like?
You know, I really liked, I always want to say his name is Tigger, but it's not.
Tagore.
He was like the Spider-Man of this comic. He provided the banter.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that, but I think Princess Callista was by far my favorite. Her, yeah. As you said, like the, oh, I'm vain thing.
But I'm trying to work on it.
Yeah, she's just an asshole. But, like, the way she plays Kyle is really good. I mean, she's probably not a bad person mostly. I mean, okay, she does kill slaves every morning. That's really bad. But she seems to be trying to prevent genocide, so that's good. You know, I don't really know what side of the fence she's on. I suspect at this point that she's not a terrible person. She's just done terrible things. But I like her manipulation of Kyle, because as the reader, I don't have, like, a good sense of where she stands. So how could he possibly, you know?
You're right. Like, she gives him the whole sob story about how she just had to murder all of those natives every day, and it was terrible. But before you get that explanation, you see her, and she seems like she's actually kind of enjoying it, maybe a little bit. And
yeah.
And her motives line up with the rest of these characters. They all want to overthrow and or destroy Citadel. But her wanting to destroy Citadel perfectly aligns with her Brahmin past. Like, their people were kicked out of Citadel and given this planet to rule. I get the sense she and her people are still kind of pissed about that. And I don't necessarily see that her overthrowing Citadel is for benevolent reasons or even guilt over murdering all those natives. Like,
yeah.
It might just be a cultural hatred of Citadel that she wants to overthrow them. And I don't know. Like, like you're saying, it's hard to tell where she is because she does such a good job of lying to Kyle and manipulating and playing every angle and playing every side. And it makes her immediately questionable as a character because you have no idea what her real motive is. But her motive, as described when you first meet her and as she describes the situation of her people in relation to Citadel, I mean, her motives might not be altruistic or benevolent or anything at all. She might just want to grab that power and overthrow them for fucking kicking them off Citadel. It really could just be that.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell because she says one thing, we see her do another. But I do believe her that she is trying to prevent something worse from happening. Because at this point, she's put herself in a lot of danger.
Yes.
And it seems like she wouldn't have been an active player in this plan if all she were trying to do was a power grab. She does make several allusions that her family is the type that fights, it does the work, and she says, like, in that first scene with her, I am not afraid to do work. But yeah. This goes beyond putting in the time and effort. This is, like, she's genuinely putting herself in danger. So maybe she actually is not being entirely selfish here. It's hard to tell at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, it is hard to tell. And that doesn't make her, it makes her a really good, interesting character.
Yeah, and I mean, I thought she was cool. And I, oh man, when issue 7 ended, I was like, that's the end? it looks like this trade actually got gathered into a 12 issue.
Yeah, the entire run is 12 issues. And come August, they're going to come out as a collection.
Oh, nice.
So we're kind of jumping on this one. 1 through 7, I think, if I recall, those were the issues that released in 2015, which is why they're in our best of 2015 series.
But yeah, I'm definitely reading the other ones because I absolutely want to see how this plays out, and I really want to know what side she's on.
Yeah, and I mean, this has this team in this comic is kind of cool, right? Like, it's got that heisty feel. And a little bit of that Guardians of the Galaxy kind of feel, like these guys are outlaws and misfits, but you know that they're doing the right thing. At least you have a feeling that they're doing the right thing, or they're trying to. Because Citadel is plainly evil, and these guys are doing bad things, but they're not doing evil things.
Yeah.
There's that line, and I get the system. I get the sense that in this Vega system, that just doing bad and not doing evil kind of makes you good. Like, it doesn't take a whole lot to be a good guy here. And it makes this whole thing feel loose and fun and cool, and it's fun to just read along with it.
Yeah. Did you have any favorite characters?
I really liked Brute. I like the language construction, and then when we get his issue, when he goes back to his home planet, and the thing with the Pontifex, like, took him as his son, and halfway through you realize that this whole thing, like, the Pontifex has orchestrated all of this so that he can get Brute to be his adoptive son again. He just wants Brute to come home, and he knows that the way to make that happen is with money and bribing priests. And getting Citadel behind it. That's the only way he's going to get Brute back and get Brute accepted again. And the masses will do, like, whatever. But Brute also is able to show everyone how corrupt Pontifex is and show everyone why he left when Pontifex, like, does all of that and then gives it all up because Brute's not going to let him keep the money.
Yeah. Like,
when he realizes he's not going to keep all the money, the Pontifex is like, oh yeah, okay, no, fuck you, Brute. You're somebody kill him.
That made me so sad, actually, where he is like, see, you're my son. And I was like, oh, maybe this guy's not super terrible. And then Brute gets the key and he's like, give it to me.
It's
like,
yeah.
Okay, well, you know, one more bad person. But no, I actually like that. And I think, assuming that their lore is correct, that makes Brute a true believer.
Yeah.
He's not just like a strong guy. He is someone who genuinely believes in, like, the whole Alpha Omega religion and was deemed worthy.
Yeah, that's true, because he's the one who finally breaks the stone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably some, like, Arthurian stuff we could ponder on there if we think about it hard enough, honestly.
Probably. And probably the reason he's the one is because he knows the truth of the church, but looks through it to see the truth of his belief, right? Like, that's why none of the peasants before could break it, because they didn't know the truth of the church. They were believing blindly, more or less. And they could believe and have faith as blindly as they want, but that's not true belief in the way that will break the rock. And the priests obviously can't break it because they're just getting bribes left and right. But Brute knows both sides and still believes. And that's, I think that's why he can break it, which is fucking sick.
Yeah, it was, that was probably my favorite scene where he's like, it will kill me, but this is not the end. And
yeah.
I don't know, it's just like really cool. He has like his single tear.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of Primus?
You know, they didn't do anything with him. He's just like, I can't decide if he's the side dude or the main dude at this point.
Right, like you think he's the leader for a while and then it turns out he's not.
Yeah, like I kind of think that he got one-upped by Kyle in terms of romance times. But, you know, okay, he was a slave leader and then he shot a dude and, you know, they didn't do anything with him.
See, my guess is he was the leader of the Omega Men. And this, I haven't really read Omega Men. There's been two other runs of it before this. I haven't read either one of those, and my knowledge of this group is really, really limited. But my guess is he was the leader, and then Callista came in and manipulated him the same way she manipulated Kyle. And was like, oh, I see a group of people that can help me achieve my means. Let me just swoop in here and get them doing work for me. Like, Primus is in love with Callista, and so is Kyle. And the same way I don't believe that Callista has any feelings for Kyle, I don't genuinely believe that Callista has any for Primus.
Yeah.
I have no reason to believe that more than any other character that Callista might, quote-unquote, be in love with.
Well, also, you know the scene where they've been captured by the Citadel and they're getting interrogated? It has flashbacks for each of them. And we see Callista in bed with Primus, and she's convincing him that he needs to join this cause, that he needs to be part of it.
Yep.
And it's kind of the exact same thing she did to Kyle.
Yep.
So, I don't know. I feel bad for him, but he wasn't interesting to me in this.
Yeah, the idea is kind of neat, like a badass, roguish Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
You know, or like a badass Gandhi, like just the non-violent protestation in the face of extreme violence. Like, cool, man, that's awesome. But that's just like two frames.
Yeah, and I actually really liked his little speech at the start to Kyle where he talks about how he wasn't teaching his people to fight or rebel. He was teaching them to stand.
Yeah.
And that is actually a really good way to go about it, I think. You know, to say, like, look, you're people who have worth. And that is kind of the heart of peaceful protests, to get a population to make demands about what they deserve as people, but not shed blood. And that's really cool, but my only disappointment is that seems to be all we really get from him in that regard. Just that one little, almost throwaway line.
Yeah, and you get the sense, I mean, I would also love to see what happened to that. Like, he's given that up, obviously, to become Omega Man, come to be an Omega Man. And you get that scene, and you get the sense he's kind of disappointed in his people for not following his lead. That not all of them did, you know?
Yeah.
And I just, the idea of the character is really cool, but like you're saying, you don't really get to see enough of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's entirely possible that in issues 8 through 12, there will be more development. So,
yeah,
again, another reason to read.
Yeah, it's only four more. I don't see why I'm not going to read them.
Yeah.
Or five more. Yeah. What about Doc? I feel like Doc was kind of cool, like a little bit of R2 meets C-3PO, because those are the only two robots I know. Except every time I saw his legs, it weirded me the fuck out.
He totally reminded me of Crow from MST3K.
Yes.
Like, the way his eyes were shaped.
Yeah, like, oh, you're right.
You know, he's a big Wally. He's a big, sarcastic Wally.
Yeah, but he has, like, I don't know why it threw me off so bad. He's got like the four like horse legs with hooves even.
Do they have hooves?
It looked like he had hooves.
that. I did not notice
that. They might not have, like, shoes on them and everything, but it looked like the bottom was a different color, and it kept throwing me off so bad. And I was like, what the fuck is going on here? I get it, sentient robot, but the design's weird. Why not just make him float? Or was he floating sometime? I don't know.
You know, we don't actually see his bottom half too often. It's mostly his...
his top half.
Yeah, his eyes. So. Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, I see. He's like a little... I've seen something that looks like this. I don't know. He's Wally meets like weird droid. Yeah. Let's see. Have we talked about everyone? Or Scrap.
Yeah, Scrap.
She is Scrappy.
Which, okay, this is totally not fair to Tom King and the artist, but because Overwatch is so close to coming out, all I saw was Tracer. All I saw was Alien Tracer. Two guns, same kind of build,
like
same
orange jumpsuit thing.
Sassy attitude. All I saw was Tracer. I like that she cussed a lot. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, and she's she seems to have an interesting relationship with Brute.
Yeah.
Because what he's like the straight man to her funny guy.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a good relationship. I think it's a testament to this comic that I like all of these characters, but as we're talking about them one on one, I realize not all of them have a lot of depth. And I think this is a great example of a team comic and the team being greater than the sum of its parts.
Yes.
Like, this team is fun to watch and fun to read together and fun to follow when they're together. And they make for a good story. But I don't think I'd want to... I don't want a Tigor one shot, you know? I don't want a Brute solo run. I got the Brute that I need, and I like is Brute with these characters, you know.
Yeah, and you know, like you said earlier, I think you made a comparison to Guardians of the Galaxy. I feel like they work in that regard, where alone one of them would be either dull or overwhelming, but all together they balance each other really well. It's a solid ensemble cast.
Yeah.
So
how about that art?
I really like the art for this week.
Yeah.
It was clean. I really like the whole thing where it's like a lot of the pages are kind of laid out in similar ways. So it's like each page is divided into thirds, and those thirds are divided into frames as needed. But it was just this constant framing pattern that allowed me to just know right away what the author, or sorry, what the artist wanted to do in terms of like flow of time and movement. And then I could just look at those backgrounds that are so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, I think the simplicity of the framing was just like spot on.
Yeah, and you're right, the backgrounds too matter a whole lot, because this system and the planets within it are supposed to feel separate and unique from the rest of the DC universe, because this is the lawless system. There are no lanterns here, there are no heroes here, there's just the law of Alpha Omega and the Citadel. And if you're going to pull that off, this system has to feel unique and different from the rest of this universe, and it does, because of this art. And it does a good job of even making each system feel separate from the universe, but also separate from each other as they're drawn. It's really cool. And Barnaby Bagenda. Yeah, I remembered it because it's a fun name. Barnaby Bagenda does a great job with this. And, yeah, whoever did the colors, too.
Yes. So what I like about this is I think artists tend to have like a really strong point in one thing or the other, but this has like strong facial expressions, strong like movement. That fight scene where it's just like I think 18 panels where Tigor and the princess Calista? Are fighting.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah.
Oh, that's my favorite spread in this. It was so good. And then, like, also just the background, like the cityscapes and the galaxy, like the Starry Night stuff. It looks nice, but the walls, like, you go into any given scene where people are hanging out in like a fucking dump and the walls are beautiful. And I think that is just really good attention to detail and aesthetics. Like, I never freaking notice walls in a comic, yet here I am being like, wow, these look so good. I would totally live in this shithole. You know? Like, I love the art here. I think it's gorgeous.
Nice. Yeah, and did you read the individual? Because it's not collected yet, so you have to have read the individuals. Mm-hmm. The covers are fantastic.
Yes.
They're like travel posters, but they're all graffitied over or have blood on them or something.
And they all have like a motto on the front that, like, let's see, the first one is beware, and then, like, let's see, I have number two somewhere around here stowed. But, like, each one has, like, a motto or slogan that's tied to the theme of that specific comic.
Yeah.
Oh, victory is assured is the second one, and it has, like, all the fighter ships.
Oh, nice.
And like, the Omega symbol, it's so good.
Yeah. Those are all great. Yeah, and you talk about the slogans. There were the slogans on each cover. There was the song that Scrap sings,
mm-hmm.
which is fun. And then my favorite one-liner was when they're escaping the planet, when Calista and Kyle are escaping with the fake hollow identities and stuff, mm-hmm. and the shuttles, like the slogan for the shuttle company was it Vegas Systems gets you there. Most of the time.
Yes, that was super memorable.
Because before that, I was sitting there thinking, like, these, like, in case we take fire, please read, you know, page 8, section 32 of the, like, it's just like when you're in an airplane and they're like, in case of an emergency landing over water, the inflatable raft is located in the aft of the plane. It was just like that, but, you know, in case of gunfire. In case we get shot down, like decompression protocol. What the fuck are you gonna do? You're gonna get ejected out in space and die.
And it's like no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
Okay. So admittedly, it is, you know, the Omega men. So why would they? But like you're under the assumption, at that point, that they are like normal civilians, and everyone's just like dicking around, not paying attention to the notice. It's just like being on a plane.
Yeah. Hey, but actually, that scene was really cool with the coloring and the art. How when it flipped the gray and in color, did you notice that?
Mm-hmm. And when it was in color, it actually showed each of the characters. And when it was gray, they were once again random civilians.
Yeah.
That was really clever.
That was awesome. That was really well done. So that, like, if you were paying attention, oh, yeah. You know. It was cool. That was really well done. So, you want to get ahead and rate this?
Yeah. Let's do it.
You go first.
Okay. You know, I enjoyed this. I think I will remember it. And that is actually one of my major criteria for, like, the best of comics, because they might be good, but if you're best of a year, it's got to be memorable.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give this a 4. I think it had a slow start. It took me a few issues to get engaged, but by the end, I was ready to read the rest of the run. The art is gorgeous. I think not every character was developed, but it was a good ensemble cast. Like, they're interesting. You don't get too much of anybody. It's balanced well. So yeah, 4.
Yeah, that's actually your barometer is pretty good. Like, what is good and what is bad for a best of? Like, Best of 2012. Let's see how many you remember having read. Saga. Yeah. Batman, Court of Owls.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I forgot we read that one. Hawkeye, My Life as a Weapon.
That was good. Oh, I remember the censorship in that specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they put sound effects over his ding-dong.
Yes. Underwater Welder.
Yes.
I think got a unanimous fives. East of West.
And David brings up Underwater Welder a lot, too.
Oh, yeah. East of West was best of 2013. East of West. Superior Spider-Man. I forgot Superior Spider-Man.
I can't remember that.
That's the one where Doc Ock is in Peter Parker's brain. Private Eye. Do you remember Private Eye?
Yeah. You know, I actually paid for the rest of that.
Ooh, yeah.
They have like a pay what you will system. Yeah,
Panel Syndicate.
Yeah, and they actually released a new comic. I like that one enough that I signed up for their newsletter, which I never do. Yeah.
I would like spam from you, sir.
Yes, I was like, I am impressed. Send me mail.
Yeah.
That is a privilege.
Yeah. Mind management? I think about that. That's one of those ones I think about, and I want to know the rest of the mystery that it had talked about, but not enough to actually read it.
Oh, yeah, because she's, like, in the Middle East and is, like, having memories. Yeah, I remember it, but I couldn't tell you the plot in a cohesive way.
I just remember the well-done marginalia.
Yeah.
Boxers and Saints. That's, like, one of my all-time favorites. I'm never going to forget that one.
I mentioned it last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, Serenity, Leaves on the Wind. No, I don't remember that one. Forever Evil.
I don't remember. Oh, was that Lex Luthor?
Yes.
I remembered it was Lex Luthor. I don't remember anything else.
The Wicked and the Divine. That one was pretty good. Sex Criminals. That was
solid. I will remember that for the rest of my life.
Very unforgettable. Ms. Marvel, yeah. No normal. Ms. Marvel was baller.
I think I remember Ms. Marvel almost more because of all the media surrounding that comic. The comic was solid. I do remember the events of it, so there's that.
How to Be Happy. I forgot about How to Be Happy.
So, okay, I actually found the author on Instagram, and she is so badass. She started this bike tour. She's in, like, day 37 of it right now. She started in Tucson, Arizona, and she's, I think, going all the way to the East Coast. And she's doing a comic diary of it.
Sick.
So her name on Instagram is, you can just search like Eleanor Davis Instagram, but it's Squinky Ello, E-L-O. And she's like made it to Mississippi. And I'm like, this woman is a badass.
That's cool.
So I absolutely remember that comic because I'm now reading her other stuff too. Even if it's just like diary comics.
Yeah. See, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? I remember that one quite a bit.
I always want to recommend that one to people, and I'm like, this is too sad.
I always want to recommend it, but I don't want to be like, hey, you know, your parents are getting older and they might die soon. Here's a comic.
Yeah, that's how I feel too, because people approach me in conversations about this kind of issue, and they're kind of like, this is rough. I don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, I could recommend a great comic about this, but that's awkward.
Yeah. Andre the Giant, Life and Legend. I forgot about that one.
Yep. Oh, I totally remember that. I love that one.
Seconds.
Brian Lee.
Yeah, I remember you hated that one.
I still have like a raging hatred for that comic.
Oh, Lazarus. Greg Rucka's Lazarus.
That was okay. I forgot that one. I remember that. Forgettable. The premise.
That one's forgettable. Axis, yeah. Avengers, and X-Men.
Nuh-uh.
Totally forgettable. Moon Knight from the Dead. That one was hella good.
That was very good.
That's one I want to go back and get an omnibus of when that run is over.
Yeah.
Just get a nice bound collection. And then the last one that we have to look back upon is Multiversity. It's Grant Morrison for you.
I have no recollection of this.
It's very Morrison, which is probably why you just shut it out of your mind.
So,
okay. All right. That's all of the best ofs that we've had for the last 2-3 years? 3 years. So, Your four rating, I think it's pretty solid in there. I think this is one I'll remember from the set. Like, looking back like this, I'd put it higher than Avengers, or Axis, Avengers, and X-Men. Definitely higher than Multiversity, fucking Grant Morrison. Higher than Lazarus, Seconds. I mean, it does hold up against a lot of the other best ofs from previous years that we've read. But I don't... It's not in that top 4.5 or 5 territory either.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite hit the same notes that, like, that Boxers and Saints does, or Underwater Welder, or How to Be Happy, or Can't We Talk About... It doesn't hit that level.
You know what it is? There, some of those comics on that list, I am damn evangelical about. Like, I will scream from the rooftops, you need to read this, to, like, anybody I know. And this is not a comic that I would say that about.
Yeah.
This, like, is for some people I know, but not every single human I encounter.
I have bought multiple copies of Boxers and Saints and send it to people because everybody needs to fucking read that comic book. But I don't see myself sending this to anyone. The art's really good and the story's fun, and Tom King did a really good job of doing the very difficult thing to do of writing a team book where the sum is better than the parts.
Yes.
That's really hard to do, because almost always you write a team book and one character is way more awesome than the rest of them. Or one character is somebody you really want to follow. Or you want to take apart the histories of each of the people. But this isn't, that doesn't happen here. These characters work great together and like meld well together. And they're more fun to read together than I think they would be apart. So... your 4 is right on point. I'm going to give it a 4 as well.
Cool.
I feel like that's what we need to do. Give it a 4. So that retrospective made me realize just how overboard we've gone, like, with the best ofs. The first year, we straight up just did 4, and then we did 6, and then we did... Hold on. How much did we do the third time? We did 4, and then 6, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, what? 12... 13. We did 13 best ofs. And now we're going to do 10. We're doing 10 this year.
that's like a quarter of the year.
Episode. Yeah. But it's fine, because we're reading, I mean, we read the best. We read good comics. Yeah. And the idea is that even though these were best of 2015, best of 2016, these are the comics that will kind of define that year when you think back about it. So these are definitely worth reading, and we're trying to pick the stuff that's going to matter in the future. I don't know if we did this week, or I know we did last week, fucking Midnighter.
Yeah.
But we'll see with next week. Next week we're going to read Batgirl, The Batgirl of Burnside by Cameron Stewart and Brandon Fletcher. This comic is, it's a retcon. I ain't going to beat around the bush. Cameron Stewart and Brandon Fletcher at issue number 35 of the New 52 run turned Barbara Gordon into a college freshman. Like a wunderkind. She's admitted younger than she should be. She's really smart. She's in some kind of advanced program. But Batgirl is no longer like the librarian. Batgirl is now a student in a different field, and it's Batgirl in college. She lives in a trendy part of Gotham called Burnside. And all of these changes were to make Batgirl fun again. Because the Bat family and the Bat universe is a lot of dark shit. And Dick Grayson tries to pull away from it sometimes. But there's nobody that feels fun in the DC universe, and this Batgirl of Burnside is supposed to feel kind of fun again. I think a lot in the same way Birds of Prey did when Gail Simone was writing it. So we'll see. That's next week of Batgirl, the Batgirl of Burnside. Until then, everybody, goodbye.
Goodbye.